Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to conclude our analysis of the book Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. The book was authored by Stephen Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, published in softcover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. Stephen Singular is described on the back flap as a, quote, Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller A Killing in the Family and Charmed to Death. As we have seen, Singular was contacted by a highly placed source within the L.A. legal system, someone who had access to information from a number of different sources, not only the police, but the DA's office, the criminal laboratory, and elsewhere within the L.A. legal system. Singular's source contacted him specifically because of his work on the murder of Alan Berg by the Nazi group The Order, and his source indicated to him that similar elements within the LAPD and legal system had framed O.J. Simpson. Recall the earlier series, Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, about the tactic that is being employed by Nazi elements, not only in this country but elsewhere, of infiltrating the police department and the military in order to acquire, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote, to overthrow the state. In this last segment, we're going to examine the performance of the defense, the prosecution, and beyond that, the society as a whole. We have already taken a look at the failure on the part of media executives contacted by Stephen Singular to approach and to investigate the truth concerning this particular event. We have already looked also at the curious failure on the part of F. Lee Bailey to bring up the blue plastic object, quite possibly an LAPD evidence bag, that was found just on the other side of a cyclone fence adjoining O.J. Simpson's property. A singular source told him that this particular piece of blue plastic was indeed an LAPD evidence bag that had been used to transport the famous bloody glove that was found on O.J.'s property. I would point out that, as Singular notes, initially in his testimony, Mark Furman referred to finding them, meaning the bloody gloves. Later it was a glove. This contradiction was never explained. As I indicated, with regard to the O.J. Simpson case as a political and sociological event, I think identifying the names of the true killers and even identifying specifically who the law enforcement elements were who framed O.J. Simpson is relatively unimportant. I do think it's important to understand that apparently Nazi elements within the L.A. legal system were culpable for the framing of O.J. Simpson, but I think the specific identification and prosecution of the individuals involved is not important. Also, I don't think it's ever going to happen. In fact, I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell it's ever going to happen. Rather, I think that it is important for us to understand the O.J. Simpson case as a political and sociological event, sort of a modern Dreyfus case, because this country as a whole failed. This society as a whole failed, and it really was the United States of America that was responsible for the framing of O.J. Simpson, I think even more, and then for the murders of Ron and Nicole, even more than the individuals that actually committed these acts. For if this were not a failed society, then things would not have proceeded as they did. Indeed, I think everybody, or just about everybody, was to blame. Not Stephen Singular, not his source within L.A. Legal system, but I think all of the major elements involved, the media, the prosecution, the DA's office, the police, and the defense team, performed very poorly. We've already examined the curious behavior of F. Lee Bailey in not using a blue LAPD evidence bag and in not pointing out the photograph of this bag lying just on the, or this blue plastic object lying just on the other side of that cyclone fence. We dealt with that in an earlier segment. Indeed, Singular in his book indicates that Judge Ito may have ruled against the defense with regard to admitting most of the taped segments that Mark Furman had recorded with Laura Hart McKinney. Singular hints that perhaps Judge Ito was dissatisfied with the defense's failure to utilize all of the information at their disposal to prove O.J. Simpson innocent. As it was, they simply simply were able to introduce enough doubt about O.J. Simpson's guilt, whereas it appears that they could have actually proved him innocent. Of Ito's ruling on the Furman tapes, Singular writes, "The prosecutors, led by Marcia Clark, argued that because the defense had failed to offer any proof whatsoever that evidence had been planted in the case, the Furman issue was closed and the trial should move on. In his ruling, Ito agreed with Clark's contention. It would have taken a, quote, leap in both law and logic, unquote, the judge wrote, to believe that because Furman may have engaged in misconduct in years past, he'd done similar things on June 13, 1994. Since last November, the judge pointed out, the defense had had more than ample opportunity to bring forward anything showing that a glove had been planted on Simpson's estate, but they hadn't done that. Evidence tampering in this case, the judge concluded, was, quote, a theory without factual support, unquote. I would interject that, in fact, there's a great deal of factual support, but the defense did not properly utilize it, and that raises the question about why. Initially, I sided with the defense's response to the ruling. I found it unfair that the jury would not get to hear more of the tapes and decide for themselves what Furman may or may not have done. But then I began to wonder if the judge had not been correct. More than a year before Ito issued this ruling, I'd approached the defense and described to them physical objects that I'd been told had been used to move the glove from Nicole's condo to Simpson's home. Had these things been adequately investigated by O.J.'s lawyers? Why hadn't the defense attempted to back up their allegations against Furman with something more than charges of racism? Why was it so difficult to get attorneys to deal in specifics as opposed to possibilities and abstractions? All the lawyers talked about was, quote, a search for the truth, unquote. But who was really practicing this in the courtroom? Indeed, I think similar questions can be asked, and Singular asks them, about the failure of the defense to adequately utilize the information concerning the EDTA preservative. Of the EDTA question, Singular writes, and by the way, the Martz here is FBI agent Roger Martz, who had performed the EDTA tests. After Martz had ended his testimony for Tuesday, July 25th, I watched on television as Carl Douglas was leaving the courthouse and being interviewed by several reporters. He told the media he had no doubt there was EDTA in the blood samples the FBI had examined, no doubt whatsoever. I recall the 20 or so times last summer when Douglas had explained to me that the blood could not have been planted, and my efforts to have the defense team test the blood for EDTA were going to prove futile. And again, by the way, I would interject, although I have not covered this, Douglas initially indicated to Stephen Singular that there's no way the police could have planted evidence. That raises more questions than it answers. Indeed, I think it calls into question to a certain extent, if not the integrity, then the professional competence of Carl Douglas. There was obviously plenty of opportunity for the police to have planted evidence, and regardless of which officers actually did it, it appears pretty clear that evidence was planted. Continuing. I guess he'd been right all along. They had never done this work or discovered something tangible which they could have then presented to the jury. They just hired a scientific expert who was paid to muddy the waters. Over the past few months, I'd spoken at length to a few media personnel who were covering the trial, and one or two of them had told me that the defense had known about EDTA long before I'd arrived in Shapiro's office last August 8th. I initially resisted this idea, but it turned out to be true. A recording of the preliminary hearing testimony of Thano Paratis, P-E-R-A-T-I-S, the nurse who'd drawn Simpson's blood on June 13, 1994, was played in the courtroom in August of 1995, and this man had indeed mentioned a preservative that could be found in a stored blood sample. So EDTA had been brought up early on. And again, I think the defense's failure to exploit this, as well as the plastic bag and other things, raises some interesting questions. Continuing. After learning this, I couldn't help wondering if Carl Douglas had played me for a fool all along. Had he already been aware of everything I had to say about EDTA from the moment we first began talking? And had he simply not wanted me to know this? Or had he truly been as ignorant of the subject as he seemed to be whenever it had come up? While thinking about these things, I called Dr. Ambruso, the blood specialist in Denver who had spoken with both Douglas and Barry Scheck about EDTA. Dr. Ambruso, A-M-B-R-U-S-O, it seemed to me, might have a more objective response to these questions than I did. Quote, when I was contacted by Scheck and Douglas, Ambruso told me, they had no concept of what was going on with EDTA. None at all. I had to explain everything to them, all of the issues of testing for the anticoagulant and measuring it. I told them I wasn't an analytical chemist, so I really wasn't the person to run the test for them, but I could help them find someone qualified to do this. I told Scheck that since he had never done this sort of thing before, he needed to start from scratch and do it right in order to prove what is really there. It takes time to accomplish that, unquote. I asked him, Brusseau, about the FBI tests that were run on the blood samples in the Simpson case and about the confusing results that had come out of this process. Quote, I don't think that the FBI knows anything about EDTA, he said. You have people posing as experts in a field where they are not experts. All of the forensic scientists I talked to about testing for EDTA in a criminal case had never heard of anything like this before. It's new, and it's a complicated issue. If this FBI agent had never tested for EDTA in the past, I would be very suspicious of all of his findings. You need to run a good, tight scientific investigation to find out the truth, or what you end up with is a half a blank blank job. If this was to be the heart of the defense's case, and if this was their way of showing that blood was planted, it was not worth holding your breath for. I'm amazed at how much time and energy and resources we've devoted to this trial, and at how little we have discovered. I still marvel at the human comedy of this situation. In the next segment of Singular's book that we're going to examine, we're going to deal with the overall implications of this case for the United States. Again, this was a profoundly political, saying a profoundly significant political event, and yet it has been dealt with as though it were some sort of joke. I don't think that the proper political analysis has yet to be offered by most of the media voices about just how significant the O.J. Simpson case was. And again, the suspicion on my part is that this may very well have been a domestic intelligence operation, specifically a type of operation known as a psychological operation. We're going to begin with some of the closing arguments that the defense presented. In their closing arguments on September 27th and 28th, 1995, Cochrane compared Furman to Adolf Hitler, and Barry Scheck said that Andrea Mazzola's initials were not on the crime scene blood swatches as she'd once testified they were. The implication was that the swatches were sent off to Cellmark for DNA testing, or the swatches that were sent off to Cellmark for DNA testing were not the same ones Mazzola had collected at Nicole's condo on June 13th. They'd been switched. And again, Singular's information from his anonymous source was that that is what had happened. And of the reaction on the part of the African-American and white communities, respectively, Singular writes, many African-Americans exploded with joy at the verdict. Most white Americans responded in exactly the opposite way. Because of this trial, the country was as divided along racial lines as it had been in decades. Interjecting, that may have been one of the reasons for this psyop, if in fact my hunch is correct. Again, this reaped tremendous political hay for the forces of reaction. Beginning again, because of this trial, the country was as divided along racial lines as it had been in decades. Simpson's defense team had triumphed, but at what cost? More than a year earlier, I tried to tell Douglas that larger issues were involved in this case than mere winning or losing, but that was not what he'd wanted to hear. His side was fond of saying they had no burden to prove anything, and in fact, they had done little to prove that a glove had been moved or that Simpson's blood had been planted. They hadn't run the crucial blood test for EDTA, so the issue had never been clarified. O.J. was free, but nothing really had been settled. The pain had not gone away. If anything, it had grown worse. The day of Simpson's release, L.A. County District Attorney Gil Garcetti publicly stated that the case was closed. L.A. Police Chief Willie Williams soon echoed his sentiments, saying that there were no other leads to pursue. I would interject that analysis would appear to be less than accurate from the information Singular has presented. Continuing with the text, these declarations put me in a quandary. What was I going to do with the, quote, leftover, unquote, information in my possession? If Garcetti was satisfied that the case had ended with a verdict, and if the defense had now won and was moving on to other things, I could not so easily rein in my own curiosity. I believed that the murders may have involved a very different scenario from the one the jurors had so abruptly rejected. There was reason to believe that Ron Goldman may not have arrived at Nicole's condo alone on the night of June 12, 1994, and reason to believe there was much more to learn about what had happened that evening at 875 South Bundy. A few months after the murders, Goldman's psychiatrist office was burglarized and his file was stolen. Whoever took it may have wanted to know what the young man had told his doctor about his financial condition. I still had far too many questions to let these killings go, questions the legal system had done nothing to answer. Watching the aftermath of the verdict was nothing short of awful. White Americans, including many people in the media, were profoundly disturbed by what they viewed as the exoneration of a dangerous murderer. The most outspoken critics went so far as to imply that the jury wasn't smart enough or didn't have the moral courage to make the right decision. African Americans, including some jurors, were understandably insulted by this reaction. They saw it as one more example of ingrained, institutionalized racism. Simpson had won the case on the evidence, they believed, and it was completely unfair to say that he was acquitted because of skin color. I would point out, too, that the prosecution was apprised of Stephen Singular's information, and just like the defense, they did not utilize it properly. In the aftermath of the trial, Christopher Darden, just like other people involved on all sides of the case, has published a book, and he has also been interviewed by Barbara Walters and has appeared on the cover of Newsweek alongside his, quote, his case against O.J. Well, before nominating Christopher Darden for any citizenship medals, I think people should be aware that the very compelling, though far from totally airtight information that Stephen Singular was given, was presented to Chris Darden. And Chris Darden, just like everybody else in the case, including the defense, for the most part, ignored the information that Stephen Singular gave him. Stephen Singular, in fact, contacted Citizen Darden a couple of times. Turning to Legacy of Deception, on Sunday, June 4th, while giving a speech in Los Angeles, Darden said he was deeply disillusioned with the Simpson case and with the practice of law in general. When the trial was over, he might even quit the profession and find something else to do. After listening to news reports about Darden's comments, I decided it might be a good time to try to reach him. He'd always struck me as being more open-minded than Marcia Clark, and the fact that he was African-American could not be discounted. Perhaps in his own way, he'd been asking for help in his speech over the weekend. Perhaps he was ready to hear something he hadn't heard before, or if he had already heard it, he'd simply brushed it aside. On Monday afternoon, June 5th, court was not in session, so I called his office. He answered the phone. I told him my name, and he seemed taken aback, almost frightened. I explained to him that Dominic Dunn had told me that he wanted to speak with me. "There are some people with me at the moment," Darden said in a virtual whisper. "I can't talk right now." "When can you talk?" "It would be a lot better if I called you. I'll call you tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. "All right, I'd like to talk with you," unquote. He never phoned back. And still later, Stephen Singular contacted Chris Darden after the case to see if he was interested in pursuing some of the leads that he'd been given, and once again, Citizen Darden declined to take the bid and run with it. Remember this when you hear him weeping and moaning about what a terrible travesty of justice the O.J. Simpson case was. I agree with that. However, I'm afraid that Christopher Darden's performance was part of that travesty. Again, although Stephen Singular, all of the information presented by Stephen Singular is not airtight, I think he makes a very good case that in all probability, well, he makes an excellent case that O.J. was framed, and that in all probability, there were a number of killers, none of whom was O.J. Simpson. Still more about Stephen Singular's contacts with Chris Darden, this after the trial. After 2 weeks of seeing the post-verdict anger and conflict roll back and forth across the country, I could stand it no longer. I flew to Los Angeles, hoping that someone within the criminal justice system would listen to what I had to say about looking in other directions to solve these crimes. Perhaps making this flight was foolish, and just one more example of my naivete, but I went anyway. On Monday morning, October 16th, with my legal advisor beside me, I called the district attorney's office. Garcetti had once said this case was not about winning, but about justice, and I wanted to see if he would make good on his word now. We reached one of his assistants and told him I had information that needed to be looked into. I asked to meet with the DA, and the assistant said he would convey the message to his boss and get back to us. For the next 2 days, I had the essential experience of being a reporter. I sat by a telephone and waited for it to ring. The first night I stayed in my hotel room, stared vaguely at the TV set, and sensed I may have been the only person in L.A. who was intent on seeing this case go forward. It was a lonely feeling. By the middle of Tuesday afternoon, no one had called back. As my frustration level reached its breaking point, I picked up the phone and called Chris Darden. He was not there, but I tried several more times. "I'm out chasing crime night right now," his voice said on his office answering machine. "Leave a message, your name, your number, and I'll get back to you," unquote. I did not leave a message. I was tired of leaving messages. I kept trying to reach him in person, but could not. Finally, at 4:15 p.m., I dialed him once again. To my surprise, he answered, "Hello." I identified myself, not at all certain he would remember who I was. He not only knew my name, but he also had some very strong words for me. "What do you want?" he said. I told him I had some information that needed to be investigated now. "It's a little late for that, isn't it?" he said. "It's never too late for justice," I replied. "If you have something to tell me, why didn't you call earlier before the case was over?" I reminded him that I'd phoned him months and months ago after being told he wanted to speak to me. On that occasion, he promised to call me back, but he never had. He then said something that took me aback. It was so sharp and so angry and came from such a tangible feeling of frustration that for several moments I could not quite grasp what he said. "So you called me earlier," he said. "Is that what you tell yourself so you can sleep at night?" I was silent, absorbing his words and realizing that he was holding me, and many others, of course, personally responsible for setting O.J. Simpson free. "What do you want to tell me?" he said. "I want to get together and talk about some leads that have never been explored," unquote. He made a kind of groaning sound as if this suggestion were deeply exasperating. "What leads?" he said. "Can I just sit down with you and let me go talk to one of the lieutenants here. Either he or I will get back to you before 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock today? Yes. I gave him my work number and my hotel number and hung up. I called him at 5:15, 5:20, 5:30, and 5:35. Neither he nor a lieutenant called me back. That evening, I again sat by the phone in my hotel watching a thriller featuring Gene Hackman. During the most wrenching moments of the film, when the music became dramatic and created a pervasive tension inside my body, I fantasized that Darden would call right then and act just like a prosecutor on TV, hell-bent on solving a crime. But that didn't happen, not even in Los Angeles, where films are shot every day of the week. Indeed, I would note, too, that although Stephen Singular does not note it in this passage, Marcia Clark was made aware of the distinct possibility that Mark Furman was a Nazi, that he may very well have had an affair with Nicole Simpson, something that's never been proved, but information on both of those distinct probabilities, I should say, was presented to Marcia Clark, and indeed the only reason that Detective Purdy did not follow through with his allegations against Furman appears to have been the code of silence that pervades police departments. Officers do not inform on the wrongdoing that has been committed by other officers. Marcia Clark was apprised of Furman's Nazi-like attitudes and probable white supremacist connections, and she simply said that's BS. This within a week of the killings. And Chris Darden was apprised of information as well. Twice, he didn't use it. The defense didn't use the very compelling leads that Stephen Singular was able to develop. They didn't test for EDTA. And the media, as we saw earlier, did not pursue the leads given them by Stephen Singular. Repeating a passage that we read earlier in this series, and this by way of summing up the failure of all segments of society to deal properly with the O.J. Simpson case, Stephen Singular, in contacting a network executive, had the following experience. And by the way, Singular was trying to point out the probable role of white supremacist elements in the framing of O.J. Simpson. Of the network executive's reaction, he listened with great interest, and at one point he even seemed on the verge of acknowledging that there might be something in what I was telling him. He said he would take my information back to New York, where he was based, and use it to convince his superiors to work with me. He would have an answer, he indicated, early next week. My experience with him turned out to be similar to my experience with others who worked for major media outlets. I never heard from him again. I never heard that he checked out what I was saying and found it to be false or absurd. I never heard that he'd come to the conclusion that I'd been misled. I never heard anything. He took everything I gave him and he never called back. When I phoned him, he did not return my calls. Why? Because in my opinion, he simply didn't want to think about these things anymore. He didn't want to consider that police officers might hold political views that are fundamentally dangerous to all of us. He didn't want to think about other scenarios of the crimes that were different from the one he'd already embraced. He or his bosses did not want to be disturbed by any new stimuli. And indeed, I think the tragic aspects of this case, and I believe this in many ways was an American Dreyfus case, transcend the individual personal guilt of whatever elements of L.A. law enforcement may have framed O.J., whether the elements within the police department or the coroner's office or the crime lab. And indeed, I think it transcends the identities of whoever the real killers were. I don't think that's likely to be known in the foreseeable future. I think it is safe to say at this point that the killers will go free, despite the fact that there are some leads indicating who may have done it. Because this case was not about justice, it wasn't about truth, it was about winning. And again, Stephen Singular's source discussed the implications of the O.J. case, and I'm going to reread a passage that I read at the beginning of this series. "This isn't just about O.J. Simpson and a double murder," he'd said. "This is about the fragility of our legal system. This is about the power of the media and how a few well-chosen words or images can manipulate the perceptions of 200 million people. We live in a society where the presumption of innocence is supposed to be a guaranteed right. No one can exercise that right when the media run opinion polls on a man's guilt or innocence and then report that two-thirds of the citizens believe he's guilty before a jury had been selected and the trial had even begun. What if their opinions are based not on facts, but on assumptions that have no connection at all with reality? In this case, one detective jumped to a conclusion and did something very wrong. He ignored what his job really is, to investigate every possible lead, and then he convinced three other policemen to do the same thing. They disregarded their duty to society, which is to scour the crime scene and collect all the evidence while it is still fresh. Their behavior set off a chain reaction that no one could stop. The people in authority in LA's legal system immediately decided who the killer had to be. The authorities told the media they had a suspect. The media ran with the story, despite the fact that they had no real evidence to substantiate anything. The media also threw away Simpson's presumption of innocence, which they proclaimed to hold so dear. The public began believing what the media were saying as if it were the truth. Things are out of control. This case concerns more than the death of two people. It's about the erosion of our legal system and our constitutional rights. Read the Bill of Rights. See how many of Simpson's rights have already been violated. These things are not written in stone. They can be damaged or destroyed. People need to know that. We've lost our ability to distinguish between what is serious business and what is televised entertainment." And skipping down, "You've got to understand that everyone involved in this case is first and foremost concerned not with the truth, but with protecting and advancing his or her professional position. The system is not about justice, it's about winning. Amen." And still more about what Stephen Singular's source said when he first contacted him. "The most disturbing piece of information concerned the first book I'd written, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg. This book, which became the basis of Oliver Stone's 1988 movie Talk Radio, chronicled the assassination of a talk show host in Denver by a small band of neo-Nazis from Washington State. Now, in the fall of 1994, skipping down, now in the fall of 1994, I was being told that neo-Nazis were no longer operating just on the edges of American society, but had moved much closer to the mainstream. In some cases, they were inside the system itself and had become deeply disruptive. Indeed, they are acquiring specialized knowledge and abilities. That concludes this series. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening."